Hello again and welcome to Dr. Ray Talks It Over, the program designed for parents and families where the aim is to help you stand strong as a parent for your kids' sake. I'm Jerry Escher along with Dr. Ray Guarendi, father of 10, psychologist and author, and just chock full of good wisdom and common sense. Dr. Ray, how are you doing this time?
Hey, Jerry. You know, when you say chock full, I think nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and I think nuts, it just reminds me of home.
Yeah, right.
And I'm getting homesick.
I'll bet. Well, you'll be home soon to the 10 beautiful kids that we have talked about during the series.
If they're in bed, I'll call and make sure they're in bed, then I will go home.
On our last program, we talked about a book and video project that you were involved in called Back to the Family. I was very, very touched, to be very honest with you about that, because it just really gets sort of at the roots of American family traditions. I'll just let you summarize what we talked about a little bit.
We asked National State Teachers of the Year in all 50 states, who are the best families you have ever seen? We want to talk to them. We want to talk to their children. We want to ask them, how is it that you are raising these kinds of children? What is your religion? What do you think about morals? Do you spank? Don't you spank? How do you communicate? What are your fears, your worries, your guilts? How do you discipline? We simply picked their brains, Jerry, for their ideas, their attitudes, their beliefs, their practices on what makes family life strong and rewarding.
What were, briefly again, some of the main themes, findings, surprises that came to you from this study?
You asked me what was the most reassuring finding last time, and I said 25% of our families had ugly, chaotic, traumatic, nasty childhoods themselves, and they grew up to be the nicest, most solid parents that these award-winning teachers had ever seen. And for me, that was the most reassuring finding of the book, is you're not doomed by your past. We talked about religion. And what we found was that over and over and over again, these families placed faith and belief in God and seeking God at the very center of their family life. It was the driving force behind how importantly they viewed their role as parents and raising godly children. We had some trouble with that. Again, with the publishers, they didn't like that idea. The families were across the spectrum, socioeconomically, educationally. Where they tended to be different from the standard American picture is that we tended to have more two-parent families. You would expect that. Research has shown over and over that the nuclear family with two parents intact is the best way to raise good kids. We had some single moms. We had foster adoptive parents. We had a widowed mom. We had blended families, not in the proportions that you would see in the country at large.
You know, I'd be curious to know, you mentioned this one publisher again, and you talked about this incident on the last program, how the publisher had turned you down. I'd be curious to know, does this something like this turn people off a little bit because it conjures up images of what they didn't have or what they don't have now? I mean, it's sort of like the Waltons. You know, you're holding up the Waltons to people when you do something like this in some instances. And it could be, I don't know, painful, or people might just say, you know, that's just not the way it is. And yet you mentioned last time, this is the ideal that you'd like to hold up and say this is what family can be and perhaps should be.
Well, we have a chapter in the book called What Excellent Families Are Not. And I basically destroyed that stereotype. We are not holding up some syrupy, unreal, always sweet and light families. The whole chapter talks about their struggles, some of their fears and worries and guilts, their humility. These were very human people. They were just like you and me. But what they did was they had the will, the effort, and the desire to continuously seek to have a better family life. These aren't somebody that you could look at and go, well, that's not real. Who lives like that anymore? And by the way, that is what the first publisher did. Her response was, this is not real. And our response was, well, maybe it should be. Because these are not some kind of fantasy idyllic families where you say, they just got the luck of the draw, you know, they just sort of had God smiled upon them and everything went their way. No, it wasn't like that. Some of the adversity in some of these families, there were deaths of children.
Mm-hmm.
There were huge struggles. One father talked about what happened when his daughter got pregnant out of wedlock and how he dealt with that. There were situations where fathers lost their jobs. These were not people who just had stress-free existences. And the kids were not all perfect either, but the difference was they weren't kids who were morally problematic and who were socially troubled.
This series has been dealing a lot with discipline and raising kids and raising them in a moral and virtuous way. With regard to the Back to the Family Project, what did you find with regard to discipline among these families, their methods, their effectiveness, and so forth?
You and I have spent a lot of time talking about the importance of self-confidence to parents. That was a theme that came through loud and clear among these parents. There was a chapter in the book called Great Expectations. And in the chapter, it essentially says, we want our children to walk morally better than the crowd. We want our children to face the wind. Small example. One father said, I absolutely require my children to call everybody Mr. and Mrs. and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. And he said, when my kids went to their new school, the principal commented it was like they were from another planet, their manners and their politeness. But these families expected that of their children. They essentially said, look, we want you to be morally the best you can be. We're going to help you get there, and we're not going to look around us and doubt ourselves because other parents are not doing it this way. That's irrelevant to us. Very strong sense of self-confidence. How did they view the experts? You and I have talked about that in earlier shows. Essentially, I could summarize it this way. They looked at the experts as possible help, by no means the main way to guide how you raise your children. They viewed the experts as adjuncts. You might be able to give us ideas and thoughts.
Supplement what
Yes, yes. Yeah. We can learn from you, but our ideas on how we want to raise our children, we have to decide, we have to pick and choose. There are several chapters that focus exclusively on discipline. There is a chapter on spanking. As I said in an earlier interview, 70% of these parents spanked as one discipline option, not the main one, but something that they felt as parents they had a right to do. 30% did not. They chose not to. All right? They respected those who did, and those who did respected those who didn't. Mm-hmm. They viewed it as parental choice. There was a chapter on the most frustrating discipline problem among these families, and that was sibling quibbling. The chapter is titled Siblings, the Bendable Bond. And it essentially said, look, you kids can drive us crazy. One father told a story. He said, I came home from work. I pulled in the driveway, and I saw two of my boys on the sidewalk with their arms around each other going, I love my brother. I love my brother. He said, I checked the address. I went in the house, said to my wife, what's going on out here? And she said, I snapped. I couldn't take them anymore. I sent them outside, and I said, put your arms around each other and say I love my brother until your father gets home. He'll deal with you. So, you know, these are all very human people, you know, and the sibling problem was the biggest one. On a day-to-day basis, it was the biggest frustration for these families, and they talked about how they handled it, and that's where I got the suggestion on an earlier show where one mom said you sit across from each other and you're not allowed to move until each of you get permission to get up and each of you apologize. Another mom said she had a back-to-back. They had to sit back-to-back. But I don't like that one because, you know, they start moving their backside. Mom, he's pushing his backside into me. Tell him to quit it. I'm not moving my backside into you. So I usually keep some kind of distance between siblings. In my home, I try to keep 7 miles in between the siblings. 7 miles and usually a couple of brick walls, some kind of brick walls.
You have enough kids that you can, you know, if you put 7 miles between each of your kids, some would be in Michigan.
Yeah, spreads them out. It does spread them out. It's like our van. You know, we have this 15-passenger van, and I had a moonroof put on it, you know, because I still want to have some cool left, you know, from my college days. I mean, I drive by people and go, I'm pretty cool. I got a moonroof on my boat. And the front plate is Ohio and the rear plate's in Tennessee, you know. So, and I would say there was a chapter on house rules.
Right. In order for there to be discipline, there has to be a rule that is violated first.
I love house rules. God runs the world in 10 rules. I don't know how many we need to run a house. And we went through the families and said, okay, give us the house rules that you use that seem to make your family function best? What, give us the cutesy ones, give us the tough ones. Do you know the number one house rule, Jerry? By far, most often enforced at the priority of most people's parenting list and enforced with the greatest vigor. And I'll give you a clue on this. You and I talked about this in a previous show. Respect.
Okay.
Absolute number one house rule. Mm. And they took a non-negotiable stance towards it. And their view was not just respect of mom and dad, respect of everybody in the house. You don't have any more right to talk to your siblings disrespectfully as you do anybody else. And that's where we talked about the essays and the dictionary words and the job jar, because they put consequences on it, mm-hmm. very much. One mother said her house rule was who, what, when, where, and how. You cannot leave this house with anybody to go anywhere at any time unless you answer me five questions. Who, what, when, where, and how you getting there, how you coming back. And if she didn't get satisfactory answers, you can go. Hmm. And if you ever lied about one of your answers, the rope got pulled back in. One mother said, our house rule, anytime, any place, anywhere, I can call and show up. Know it. I like parents like that, you know. One mother, it was a great house rule. She said, here's my rule. If in my gut I just don't like the sound of it, what you're asking to do, and I can't give you a reason why. I can't explain it, but it just doesn't smell right. You're not going to do it. And she said, I'd rather have you mad at me than worry about you. The Italians, I'm an Italian, and the Italians used to have a phrase, Jerry, better you cry now than I cry later. And it's basically saying, look, you could be unhappy with me for now because later on I don't want my heart broken. So I like that rule. Many, many meal rules. Exceptional bunch of meal rules. Some years ago, Reader's Digest did a survey, and they wanted to find out what were the common denominators among high-achieving school kids. Number one most common denominator, you know what it was?
Always there at mealtime.
That's exactly right.
With the family.
Family meals, 3 to 5 times a week. Now, again, that doesn't cause academic achievement, but it was correlated with it. Let me tell you some of the family's meal rules. I love these. First of all, nobody leaves the table until all are done eating. None of this, I'm 14 years old, I'm going to wolf my food down, and I'm out of here. Two, no phone calls during meals. Three, no television and radio on. Now, again, these are not rules for all families, but these were some of the ones that popped up. No television and radio on. Four, this one is particularly irritating. Not to me, but to the children. All kids are allowed 10 minutes of time to talk uninterrupted about their day. Now, with the bigger families, you go 5. But that means you can't interrupt your little 5-year-old brother because he's rambling on about some silly little preschool event or kindergarten event because you're 15 years old and you're too cool for this and you don't want to hear it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And some of the families said that. We go around, you get your 5 minutes, and you can talk about anything you want. You tell us about anything that's on your mind. I think those are cute meal rules.
They probably all took part in cooking and cleaning at the mealtime, I mean.
Well, I'll tell you, we talked a lot about chores, and I would say, just from my sense of knowing American parents, that these families, as a general rule, expected more in the way of help from their children. Some years ago, I asked a group of adolescent parents of adolescents, how many of you get the amount of help from your children around the house that you would like? And I think there were probably about 60 or 70 moms and dads there. How many do you think raised their hand, Jerry?
No idea.
One or two.
Yeah, not many.
And I asked, if for those of you who didn't raise your hands, if you're not getting the help you'd like, why not? And the answers came back somewhat what you would expect. oh, it's just easier to do it myself. It's too much of a hassle to nag them and to stay on them, and I can do the job better myself, and it's not worth the grief. Another one said, oh, we're so busy, you know, they're always going in different directions, and to try to keep it up, who knows, sometimes it'll get done on a Wednesday night, and sometimes it won't get done till Friday. Others said, well, there's not that much to do, you know, I just have them take out the trash and maybe keep their room clean, and other than that, you know, we have a cleaning lady, and it's not that big a deal, and it's all done. These parents basically said, you live here, and we're going to find stuff for you to do. I'm going to make it up. I'm going to mess stuff up if I have to, so you can do this. And I looked at parents that night, and I said, you know, you have able-bodied adolescents, and they have 10 times the energy in their bodies than you have in yours. They are virtually indefatigable at that age. You remember, we used to be that age once, back at the turn of the century. Why aren't they doing these things? This is good for them. A work ethic? And these parents essentially said, yeah. We require that kind of cooperation from them. Some of the ways they got it, I told you before, the job jar. That job jar is sitting there, and at any time, you take a job jar. One mom had this creative little technique. Saturday morning, work day, first 2-3 hours of Saturday, we went through this house. She had a dartboard with chores on it, and you threw a dart, and that was your chore. And, you know, of course, the little bullseye, the real tiny one, I would probably put something like flush toilet, you know, and the big 4-foot one would be rebuild the garage,
right.
You know, but if I were a kid, I'd be down there practicing.
I was going to say, you'd have kids playing darts all week.
I'd be able to hit that toilet thing with my eyes closed, you know. I thought that was real cute. Here's another one. And we've done this in our own home. If you are responsible for making it difficult for your brother or sister to do their job. In other words, if they had to clean the front room and you went in there and you left stuff in there, you now have to do their job.
Makes everyone's job a lot easier.
Yeah, it does. Of course, you know what you get? You get sabotage. I'll take a cookie and I'll go in and I'll sprinkle crumbs on the floor and I'll say, Mom, look what he did. He threw crumbs on my floor that I just waxed. You want to make him do my other chores? Of course, nobody thought of that, but I thought of that. Look how devious I am.
Kids are pretty smart, though.
Yeah, they're weasels. They're basically weasels, and a couple of my children are more weasels than others. But children, if there's a loophole, they'll spend more energy trying to find the loophole than they would have taken just to do what you asked of them. Maybe it's part of the challenge.
Well, let's look at some more of the ways that parents dealt with some of the issues in this Back to the Family book and video. Because for the benefit of those who are listening here, we want to impart some wisdom, some knowledge. What better way to do that than what's been tried and tested? You talked about mealtimes before. That was one of the things that we wanted to talk about. What about television? You've mentioned what the rules are in your home during the course of this series. Imagine things were pretty similar with these families.
Surveys vary, but in essence, it is pretty much agreed that the average American family watches 3 to 4 hours of television per day. And the television is on in the average American home up to 6 or 7 hours per day. That was not the case with these folks. As a general rule, television was much, much less frequently watched. That was a reflection of a number of things, not the least of which is they knew that television could interfere with family life. It robs you of family time, family life. The other thing is that they tended to do activities as a family or at least community-type activities more frequently, so therefore that just reduced television time as it was. These were kind of busy folks. Thirdly, many of them simply either, I wouldn't say many, but a number of them got rid of the TV altogether. They just said, look, get it out of here. I'm not willing to go that far because there's too many things on TV I would find valuable. But many of them put the TV in an out-of-the-way place, the basement. You want to watch, you got to go down to the basement. It's not going to be in the main level of the family. Some of them sold TV time. You want to watch this? Here. Here's what you got to pay to get it. You know, and you can use the money, save it up for kinds of activities. Very few of them, as I recall, and we didn't really get into great detail on this, But very few of them actually had the specialized channels, the movie channels, the things you really have a hard time supervising.
Right.
They didn't want to mess with that stuff. I would say that overall, we didn't ask the number of TVs in kids' bedrooms. I got to believe it was almost none. And the reason I say this is that in things like the phone, they had phone rules that were even tougher than the TV rules. One family said, we have a phone that's in the kitchen, and that's the only phone we have. There are no extensions. So if my adolescent teenage children are going to get on the phone, they're right smack in the middle of the family.
I'm going to know who they're talking to.
Exactly. There's no secret conversations going on here. And they said, as a result, it really wasn't a problem getting kids off the phone because they didn't stay on very long, because what can you talk about if you're going to talk about it necessarily in front of listening ears?
They just have their friends page them on their beeper and go on onto their cell phone.
Beeper to cell phone, email me. Would you email me and fax me? I have fax and fax waiting.
What was that? I was reading something funny the other day. Father asked his son if he's coming down for dinner, and his son emailed his mother from his bedroom, what's for dinner or something. You know, what are we having tonight?
Technology can swamp us, you know. They will find the ruins of our civilizations buried beneath computer terminals.
What about, well, you mentioned social activities. Families like this, it would seem that they would probably tend to do more things together.
Ah, well, it would seem. They did do more things together. Interestingly enough, we asked the children, what are your most memorable, enjoyable times with your mother and father? And they said, one-on-one time. The children said, yes, it was wonderful doing things as a family, but when I had my mom or my dad to myself, that's what I remember most. One father had a number of girls. He would take them on dates. He'd call from work. He'd say, I'm coming to pick you up. You be ready. He'd pick them up in front of the house, and he'd take them out on a date. Yeah, that's pretty neat stuff. That's the kind of stuff that makes wives look at their husbands and go, why don't you do that? I never told my wife about that one because she'd get on me.
She'd start expecting something.
I told her, honey, I just wrote the book. I don't do that stuff. Another thing that I thought was really neat about the families. The one-on-one time, here's what happened. Many of the families caught themselves in the American grind. Taxis passing in the night on their way to activities for the children. One mother said, I realized our lives were out of control. We had no time to be bored as a family. We had no negotiable time. So I told my two sons, I think they were 12 and 14 at the time, you go in, after you take your bath, you think about it. You each pick an activity or two. The rest are gone. You decide which ones you want. Yeah, many of the families backed out of that. They simply said, we got in too deep. We got in so much on the treadmill of activities that something suffered. Jerry, I call this pursuing the good at the cost of the best. Yes, nobody would argue. It's wonderful to have activities as a family that you pursue, especially your children, sports, ballet, chess club. However, something has to give. These are not activities that don't take time away from something else. And if you get to a point where you find, I don't see my kids, or we pass, or we have three ball games per night per summer league, many of the families reassessed. And they said, we got to get off this ride. It's gone too fast.
Well, we're winding down, Dr. Ray, and obviously this series has been about trying to help parents and families, help parents raise godly kids and stand strong against things that would be bad influences on the
pull
family.
Them off
so
track.
Yeah, exactly. In our last couple of minutes, if you could just encourage parents right now, encourage families, but parents in particular, with what you've learned through the Back to the Family Project and all of your own clinical work and your own practical experience with 10 kids, some words of encouragement for parents at about the last 90 seconds.
You are the parent. They are not. The they means the experts. It means your children. It means your friends, acquaintances, and family members. You must decide. Only you know where you want to go with your family and what you want to teach your children. Other people can help you, but only you can sort through it all and make the decisions. Furthermore, in many cases, just because you are the parent, you are right. If you decide, I want to give a dollar a week allowance, that is your decision. You don't go out and take a poll of 100 other parents and go, well, how much do you give? Oh, $5.50 seems to be the average. Okay, I'll give $5.50. No, you're the parent. You can decide that if you have your reasons. And sometimes you don't even need your reasons. Because I said so is good. It's not bad. It means essentially I've decided this as a parent. Always focus on God. His truths are unchanging. Use His truth to guide you into raising godly kids. Guide what you decide by that truth. It doesn't change. Now that means you have to know that truth. You can't just go, well, I think God would want this. No, you need to know God. And you need to also understand your kids through the lens of God.
Is the Back to the Family video and book available?
Yeah, it is available. My mother's basement. There are stacks and stacks of them in my mother's basement. You can certainly get it on the website. Mm-hmm. If you go to my website, which is www.kidbrat.com. You can go there. The order form is there.
People can email you there.
Email me. I love the emails. Thank you very much. I regret that I cannot respond to all things individually. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will write with problems, and I simply don't have the time to answer each individually that way. But I certainly enjoy the emails.
Good. Dr. Ray, it's been a pleasure again as always. Thank you so much.
Jerry, thank you.
Appreciate all of you who have tuned in. Thank you for being with us for Dr. Ray Talks It Over. God bless.